Hello and welcome to the End of Seeking podcast, episode 12, with myself, Martin, and
me, Imogen.
Hello,
so
Imogen.
Weird, so awkward introducing yourself.
Yeah, so welcome.
Welcome. So we had to go on a road trip earlier in the week, and a long car trip, and we used to do them.
Yeah, we did
all the time when we were house sitting full time, and actually really looked forward to them, these long car journeys, because invariably we'd get into
conversation. Yeah. There's no way you can go when there's just two of you sitting next to each other in a long car journey. I mean, you can kind of go into yourself, but typically we would just get into these.
Which it doesn't take much for us to do that anyway, exactly. But the opportunity of a car journey was always welcome.
Yeah.
And
stuck in the car together. But this week, there was a theme that came up and we started talking about, and it was about enchantment. The word enchantment came up, and I thought it was a really beautiful word. And I don't know who I'd hear talking about this, but it really struck a chord that, you know, in many ways in the modern world, and even in the way that we construct the modern environment, you know, architecturally, for example, you compare architecture from like 300 years ago to the modernist monstrosities that are coming up, that have arisen in the especially in late modernity. There's no charm to them anymore. There's no beauty anymore, and there was a time where we would build beautiful lived environments, and now we don't. There's sort of clever architecture, you know, deconstructed forms and whatnot. It's all very cerebral, but it hasn't got much aesthetic beauty, arguably. But then we got to talking about, well, that's a personal thing, right? That's how, as well, that we can be the great shame of living egoically, living through the mind, which is very utilitarian, and arguably is we can lose touch with the living enchantment that life is.
The wonder of life. Yeah. The wonderment of life.
We take it for granted.
We do.
We say, oh, we got that covered. I know what that is. I know what this is. And our mind fills up with ideas about what is what and how that works, and we lose touch with that sense of wonder that is present actually when we drop into the heart.
Exactly. And you know, children have that naturally.
Yeah,
they're born with that sort of, you know, experiencing life for the first time without any expectations that it is either good nor bad.
Yeah.
They're just innocently experiencing that, and so there's a sort of a wondrous nature to that innocent experiencing that we lose. And I think my perception of part of the awakening process is that there's a reclaiming or rediscovery of, or a remembrance of the mystery at the heart of life, the miraculous of life, the wonder and charm and enchantment that just even the simplicity of life is miraculous, is extraordinary. You know, all we see is the mundane and the ordinary, and we become so blind.
Jaded,
entitled, these sort of things with our expectations.
Yeah.
And so we can quite easily, particularly on the spiritual search, start to look for the, you know, the fantastical spiritual experiences,
right,
and all
the peak
of this.
Experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
That thing a lot of people live from, is even on the spiritual path as well. It's just another version of that.
Yeah.
Where
shiny
you're
objects.
Looking for, the bells and the whistles and that. But you know, the trouble is looking for peak experiences is that you're always going to return to the mundane.
Yeah, and actually then you miss the miraculous in the mundane.
Yeah.
And so it's something that sort of I've observed takes over when the expectations of life fall away. There's a natural dropping out of the mind, and there's where the expectations are born in the mind. So there's a natural dropping out of the mind and down into the heart of life. And this is where there's sort of upswelling
of
that sense of enchantment with life starts to take hold.
I like that idea of the upswelling because there's this... I mean, we've talked about, you know, through the process of things like self-inquiry, you begin to discard and see through false ideas about the nature of the reality that you're actually experiencing. It's not like about adopting a position, but you test the veracity of your foundational ideas against your lived experience. And in doing so, the bad ones fall away.
Yeah.
And with it, your sort of grasping and your expectations. We talked about this last week. You know, the nature of the nature of reality when it's discovered and rediscovered, then the proximal issues like grasping, seizing, thirsting, wanting reality to be other than it is falls away, and so does a lot of suffering. But it's not just a case of stripping away and then you're left with a neutrality.
Well, it can look like that to begin with, I would say.
But there is, I would say, we talked about this before, that this sort of upswelling, this radiant, when the table has been cleared off.
Yeah. And it can for a while feel very cleared off and feel very empty and feel very neutral.
Right.
And that is a stage, sure. That is a legitimate, you know, description of how that can feel.
But then the deeper, fuller expression of that is
the maturity of that, I would say.
Is that this reality that's revealed is a sort of a radiant reality, a reality that is enchanting.
Well, there's a falling in love with life that happens.
That the moment, you don't need peak experiences. The magic and the miracle of every single moment is
every breath
is so
of
full
every,
of juice.
Oh,
you know, even the difficult stuff.
All of it. You know, all of it. Just, the fact that you can feel.
Yeah.
The fact that you can experience thought and sensation and phenomenal arisings of all descriptions and makeup.
All of it
is in fact extraordinary.
And so it's something that occurs to me, and we touched on it before, is this idea that a messaging that I think is needs looking at in about the nature of let's say egoic living, the delusion of egoic living being some kind of problem or mistake. In some sense it is, you know, in some sense it's, you know, it's not truth embodied. It's more like, you know, ignorance present.
Which sets up a particular relationship with life that can be tricky. And that's where a lot of, or most suffering comes from.
Yeah.
You were saying, but the fact that we were reframing the idea of the ego being a problem, the ego.
Yes. Thing. And so this idea, and you get it in the Nirvanic Buddhist perspective, it's samsara is a problem to be extinguished.
Or
in a sense,
you
get out of it. I'm done with this. It's just a veil of tears and a field of suffering.
Well, it's the same with Maya, the idea of Maya.
Yeah, it's an illusion. But, you know, in that sense, it's taken to be a sort of a thing that's sort of not good or not true or not worthy and it should be. But I have a...
Not a value.
But that's one spiritual... And actually, that's a slightly... I would argue that's a sort of a quite a widespread, pernicious spiritual... thing for people who are a bit on an enlightenment path,
right.
Is that the end goal is a sort of a nirvana, which is extinction. I'm right. gone. I won't be coming back here. This is my last wheelhouse, last rodeo. Thank you. I'm done. I'm done with the suffering. But I'm of a different opinion. I've come to be of a different opinion that that once the ground is of one's own being is fully recognized and established, then this becomes a garden of delight. Even the difficult, temporary, and the vicissitudes, even the vicissitudes can be ultimately this enchanting display.
Yeah.
But you need to get established in order to be able to appreciate that. Okay, this is the Leela. It's the cosmic play. It's the divine theater.
And as such, you know, like we spend all this money on entertainment and going to the movies and, you know, going to theatres and symphonies and whatever else everyone wants to do. And to me, the recognition that this is the play, all of this is the play, is where you start, you know, in the same way you can go to a movie and feel the excitement and the joy and really fall in love with the experience of being in the movie. I think that's to me what we're talking about here is the falling in love with this dream while never being blind to the fact that it is a dream, as in it is a temporary play of life, and that it is not our fundamental ground. Yes, all of this is true.
Yes,
but the dream nonetheless is miraculous. The dream nonetheless is...
And every moment of it, here's the point, that every moment of it, there's a YouTube channel, I haven't seen it around for a while, but it's a movie analysis thing. And the title of it is Every Frame a Painting.
Mm,
and, nice. You know, when you go to watch a movie, there's no filler in a good, in an artful movie, a beautiful movie, even not. It's all constructed. Every frame, like an animation movie, every frame is intentional.
Yeah.
Right? Every frame is, and you can pause it at any point. And a great movie is that no matter where you pause it, it's like a photographic masterpiece. Mm-hmm. You know, it's moving, it's cinema and it's moving and it's full of beauty and delight on that level. But if a really good one, no matter where you pause it, you go, wow, look at the cinematography, look at that guy. It doesn't matter where you stop it. Every frame of it is a painting. Every frame of it is. And what we're pointing to is that life is that.
Yeah.
Life is that, no matter whatever moment of it. You don't need to go looking for peak experiences. They come and go, sure.
Yeah.
But if you've got the right eyes,
mm-hmm.
then every moment is a work of art. Every moment is a perfect, incredible, wondrous, mysterious, miraculous moment.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of it. And that's why it's called Ananda, ultimately, because when you tune in the bliss, you know, when you drop into that level of reality and that recognition, then every moment is that, every flowing moment.
And it's not a bliss as a peak experience that comes and goes. It is the very fabric of existence is that alive love of life.
The thing is, it can get, you know, spiritually speaking, it can get really like ecstatic. And there's, you know, I would say that, you know, my own spiritual path, I've talked about the different, you know, elements of what that looked like for me, you know, from meditation to self-inquiry and, you know, some transmission energy, being aware of being in the vicinity of you know.
We haven't really talked about that, to be honest.
I thought we talked about it earlier on somewhere. Anyway, okay. So that
it's
was
out there if anyone wants part. It. Yeah.
But, you know, and this is something that, to be fair, one of the great blessings I got from Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, who you know, I was sort of following his teachings and his practices for many years, was that the ground is approaching the ground in your own experience, is often a very blissful experience, and it's charming, and the ground is bliss, and you can find that in your own experience, and that's a compass, you know. I'm not talking about pleasure, I'm talking about bliss, you know, the inner recognition of a sense of well-being, a sense of uncaused joy within, as you approach the silence and the, you know, expansion of your own being inwardly.
Yeah, a repose. It's a repose, but it's a sense of aliveness in that repose. It's not a negation of life. It's a sense of repose with the aliveness of life.
Yeah. But, you know, it feels the difference between being absolutely caught up in persistent and, you know, afflictive thinking and finding the gap between the thoughts, the silence of your own non-conceptual beingness. Mm-hmm. How that feels in terms of how good and bad, you know, even on a relative sense, you go, oh, that feels a whole lot better. That's what I'm pointing at.
The gap, you mean?
The gap.
Just for those who can't see your hand gestures.
Did I not say the gap?
You did initially, yeah.
Yeah. That gap between thoughts, which is a great, you know, for many seekers, is the great transition point,
the noticing
for the first time that I am not my thoughts, I am not dependent on my thoughts,
because those thoughts can disappear and still I am.
Yes, now you are sitting. You've noticed when one thought ends and before another one comes, there you are, in the quietness of your own being, no thoughts. And that's a revelation for a lot of people. Yeah. And it feels good. That's what I was kind of pointing to, that sense of relief from the burden of compulsive thinking.
Yeah, home.
Home, return home. And it's always been right here. It's always right now.
Yeah.
There you go, just dropping right into that. But there it is. And so the first, you know, the first thing is the gap. You know, you might notice the gap. Oh, there I am. And then you'll fall out of the gap and you're back into thinking. And then, you know, you come back to it. You might make a practice out of it, remembering, finding your way back to the silence, and the peace of that repose, as you say, the peace and the quiet joy of that repose.
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, we're talking about this gap, and it's completely aconceptual. It's prior to all conception. It's prior to any description or thought.
Yeah.
Of that gap.
Yeah.
And it's that gap is miraculous and mysterious.
It is.
It is a great mystery.
There's a progressive discovery of the nature of the gap.
Yeah.
That it goes from, I mean, it's different for people, but I would make the case that it goes from, you know, the first stepping out of the thought stream into this silent, non-conceptual, awake, alert, restful repose there, the gap. It might last for a moment, might last for longer. One can make a practice out of that, or it tends to show up as a practice. So, and the gap then might get longer. You get to spend more time in that
or side, more frequent, or
more frequent, more time, exactly.
Probably both.
And then, one notices, this is awakening, arguably, that you notice that it isn't a gap at all. It's actually the ground of non-conceptual silence in which the thoughts appear.
Yeah, because initially it feels like an in and out.
It feels like an in and out.
I'm either in the gap or out of the gap.
Yeah.
In the gap, out of the gap. You're going to the gap or you're coming out of the gap.
Yeah. It's binary.
Yeah. And then, like you said, eventually it's a recognition note. Oh.
Thoughts can come and I'm still here in this silence.
And I'm not in this silence. I am this silence. Right. I am this gap.
And then there's another progression then where the thoughts and the sensations appear in the gap. Then you realize that, not in the gap, let's call it the abiding, the self, the ground at that point. But then it, I would say the unity step there, the, of awakening is that, oh, the contents of this silent awareness that I am are the same as the silent awareness that I am. This is my own dynamic nature, and
they're not separate. They're not two separate things. Yeah.
They're just, So, but you know, I have to say, my experience, there's bliss in this. There's bliss in that. You know, that is, and living then from that, that place, the miracle of reality is naked.
Yeah.
You know,
But it's the miracle of all reality. I think that's the point that seems to be very important to me right now as I'm speaking, is it's the complete abandonment of notions and ideas of this is miraculous and that isn't. So it's because there's where we get into separation again, where we get into this is good consciousness, this is bad consciousness.
Yes, I want this and I don't want that.
And so that's why I say all.
Yes. All of reality it. As a whole.
Yeah.
Is all of miraculous. It is miraculous. So, you know, I think someone said, oh, believe in miracles. The whole thing's a miracle.
Yeah.
That truly is a miracle. And, you know, from the very, you know, philosophically and experientially, you go, well, that there is anything rather than nothing.
Exactly.
That there is awareness, that there is any experience whatsoever is, shouldn't be, you know, on the level of mind, that that just shouldn't be. You know, you can't, one, the mind can't get to the first causes of this. But that it's even present at all. No matter how you scientifically or analytically get to the bottom of it, you still come down always. You go down all the layers or whatever, the most fundamental particles to the smallest impulses, that there's even any of that. Mm-hmm. That there's, and especially that there's any awareness to witness that. Yeah. It's an impossible miracle, and it's a mystery that it should ever be present. And so I'm trying to articulate it, but the experience of it is that it is entirely miraculous.
Yeah.
It's a self-knowing miracle.
Yeah. And then, so this is why for me, the word sacred always comes up when I start to describe the nature of all of this.
Yeah.
Because although it is entirely fleeting, every moment, every part of life is brought into existence this moment.
Yeah.
To me, making this moment sacred. Yeah. Making, and it's like the divine moving in this way is what is
manifesting as this.
Yeah, exactly. And so it seems to me the natural response is not a put on response. It's just the natural response is to see not only the miracle of life, but the sacredness of this moment.
There was a great movie that was made a bunch of years ago now, called Contact, and it was based on a Carl Sagan book, I think, or Arthur C. Clarke, one of these great sci-fi writers. And it was very rude. It was called Contact, and it was Jodie Foster played this researcher and in SETI. You know, they would put these big dishes to point out of space and try to get signals, and from aliens, so it's for extraterrestrial intelligence. And so the movie is she gets the signal through, bleep, bleep, some regular signal comes through, and then it's a contact from somewhere. And it's a really rich data stream that goes on, and then they unpack it, and then it turns out it's plans for this transport to somewhere they don't know, somehow technology that's way beyond them, but they unpack all the plans, and they send her out, you know, start the engine and rotates in this mad way, and then she gets shot through in this little capsule through like wormholes. It's a great movie. It's a, you know, it's not silly in any sense, but she gets kind of shot through, and to like the far side of a galaxy, and she's there, and this capsule she's in has become kind of transparent. She's witnessing. She goes, "I'm," and she's commentating. She's got her, you know, she's got a little tech, you know, recorder on, going, "I'm seeing, I'm witnessing some cosmic birth or some cosmic event or something." And then she kind of gets overwhelmed with emotion, and what she says, "Oh my God, they should have sent a poet." And that was such a great line. Mm-hmm. That when you're faced, when you really for a moment recognize the miracle of it,
it's all of it.
You
is
need
a
to be a poet to articulate it. And so,
yeah, the leaves on the trees as they're blown by the wind.
Yeah.
I remember that really vividly. I came back from that Adyashanti retreat in, 2014, I think 2014, it was. Yeah. And I'd had that sort of pretty big shift happen. And I remember it was months after that, I was still like just really in the miraculous of life, like really sat so deeply in the pocket of that recognition.
Yeah.
And I remember listening to, I think it was Coldplay, Magic, and I was, I had that song on repeat at that time. That somehow that song was like speaking to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember sitting on our front porch in America and watching the trees blow in the wind, the leaves blow in the wind, and just, I just remember being completely blown away and enchanted by life. And just couldn't believe that I got to witness this, got to experience this, got to taste this. And it was like from that moment on, actually, I think I've never quite experienced even things like suffering the same way. You know, even when you, and it's not to say it, after that point, I went through some really dark, dark, dark times. Yeah. I did. But somehow it was never quite experienced the same. Like even like experience, and I remember a particular a time sort of curled up on my bedroom floor, really going through it at one point.
Dealing with old trauma,
And yet somehow there's this sort of underneath all of that.
Yeah.
This still this sense of wonderment that my God, the fact that I can experience all of this is insane. Is miraculous, is mysterious, mystery beyond mystery.
Yes.
That this is my experience right now. This seeming hellhole of like, I want to escape.
But that it's even
the
an
fact
experience.
That it even is.
Yes, exactly.
And the sheer magnitude of the experience, the different senses that are involved, the different thoughts that are involved, the different sensory, you know, the energetic, all of it.
Yeah, the stuff we just don't have words for, don't have names for. That's
it, and it's like forget about 3D. It's like I mean, just
well, this is where yes, exactly.
It's like I don't know how many dimensions are being experienced all at once in some of this, and it's like it is a real mystery, this life, what we're experiencing in every moment, in every breath. The fact that it is beyond words for me.
Well, that's that quote, isn't it? And there's different variations on it, so I'm just going to pick one, which is life is not a problem to be solved, but a mystery to be lived.
Yeah.
And that's exactly it. And you know, descriptions only go so far, they're functional.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is the power of satsang, the idea that you enter into a sandbox, let's say, where you start to explore and you use pointings, the like when someone, you know, the experience I went through, and this is the experience, you know, we have now with various people, is that you want to point someone back to their nature. It's all very well describing, oh, it's this, it's that, it's wonderful, it's blah, 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 and that's great to get your interest, but ultimately no amount of description is going to do it justice. You have to get pointed to the experience, and then that reality opens up for that person. That's I guess what I'm pointing to. There's a difference between knowing and recognizing, knowing and realization.
Knowledge and knowingness.
In spirit, yes, the difference between knowing knowledge as facts and concepts and the lived experience.
Yeah.
So, you know,
the lived knowingness of experiencing
what's being pointed to. Yeah. So yeah, the descriptions only go so far. The real awakening is not an intellectual, it's not an answer that the mind gets. It's an experience that you recognize.
Yeah. And so this is brings me to that this recognition of when you have that insight that opens up, it can feel quite, not for everyone, but it can feel quite contrasty. It can feel quite, whoa, I didn't recognize my nature.
First, yes, right.
Not for everyone. Some it's a gradual process for sure. But I guess I'm just sort of reflecting as we're speaking on we are never not that.
We're never not
and
that.
And that's why, you know, to find that in the ordinary is to see that actually you are never not that.
Yes. And no moment is less than extraordinary.
Exactly.
In some sense.
And so when you go, when there's an attention towards sort of, let's say, peak experiences or shiny spiritual objects of perception, there is a missing that can happen of the ordinary, the divine that is the ordinary.
Because there's no life is extra. This is what we're talking about. Life is every moment is extraordinary.
It's
every moment is divine. It's, you know, we use words like sacred and divine and
every moment is a gift.
It's a gift, and it's truly miraculous. But there's a sense that comes with that with that recognition of real gratitude.
Yep.
And devotion. I mean, to what? To whom? That's a tricky one. But ultimately, it's that sense of that arising, that upswelling, as you say, of devotion and bliss and gratitude. So there's a quote in the book that you have in front of you now that points to this devotional aspect, let's say, about and comes with the recognition, even though you know. In the true non-dual, God and self, and those are sort of synonymous ideas. Brahman and Atma are one. Anyway, you have it there. Why don't you read it?
Yeah, so it's actually chapter one of the Song of the Avadhut,
Avadhuta Gita,
one of my favorites. And I'm going to read the whole thing, actually.
Yeah,
if you
go
don't
for
mind.
It. What, the whole book?
No, not the whole book.
How long have we got?
Yeah. Okay. So, but chapter one says, truly, it is by the grace of God that the knowledge of unity arises within. Then a man is released at last from the great fear of life and death. All that exists in this world of forms is nothing but the self and the self alone. How then shall the infinite worship itself? Shiva is the one undivided whole. The five subtle elements that combine to compose this world are as illusory as the water in a desert mirage. To whom then shall I bow my head? I, myself, am the stainless one.
Whoa. Yeah, read more if you want.
No, this is...
That's it. Yeah. But the idea we've touched on before, that I always take away, that he even mentions this desire to bow. Mm-hmm. To something. To who shall I bow? It's not just idle. It's like it's recognizing the non-dual nature of reality and that Brahman and Atma are the same. Yeah. But that upswelling of devotion in and as and from and to being itself.
Yeah, and it's this devotion. This devotion comes and is felt through the recognition of everything as self.
Yeah.
I remember actually at last retreat, someone asked me, what is my experience of the people that I'm sat with on retreat? And, you know, to me, it is all self.
Right.
Yet there is an infinite expression of that self. And so in that recognition, there is a total love and joy of that infinite expression.
Yeah.
And there is a devotion to that infinite expression, yeah. Actually.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about this before, this idea that this recognition that love itself isn't in the object of love. It arises from within, mm-hmm. sometimes in response to the object of love.
Yeah, that or triggers that recognition.
Or that it comes and you're just looking for something to, you know, whatever the mechanism is, it is co-arising, let's say, the object and the subjective experience.
Exactly.
But the subjective experience of love arises within the being, independently of the object of that love,
yeah.
And we kind of want to put it somewhere often, but
yeah.
You know, once that recognition of where this love is coming from
and going to, I mean, there is no
well,
the, to, pi- there
the
is
point
no
is
to.
There is no to. It just fills up one's whole perception of reality, mm-hmm. the life love is filled up, and that love and that devotion and that wonder and that enchantment, they become, as you say, maybe not always straight away strongly,
no.
But it seems to me that
that's
fullness,
the maturity
yeah. and the deepening, these qualities and these fragrances really start to come online,
yeah. When there's, I think it comes hand in hand with a sort of so there's a lot of focus on sort of that ascent type view of awakening.
Yeah. Ascension.
So ascension.
Yeah, right.
And that is, there's different ways you talk about it, up and down, you know, these
yeah.
kind of, all these notions are really human notions, I feel,
yeah.
of a description of something that's beyond that description.
Yeah.
But we're talking roughly, we're talking about transcendence.
Right.
We're talking about the recognition of the formless ground,
yeah.
The divine nature of existence.
That we are.
Yeah.
And that all is, yeah. Okay, carry on, sorry.
I know, but I've just lost where I was going with all of that. It's like in talking about that. Okay. So there's that first wave of awakening,
yeah.
is generally towards that. Is towards the recognition of, like you were talking about earlier, mm. the gap.
Yeah.
But then there is a sort of a descension that happens,
right.
and that is the embodiment,
right.
in the human, as
yeah.
the human,
right.
of that, the recognition of that divine nature, that transcendence,
right.
as the form, as
right.
as the human. And so I guess it relates to this thing of the subject object of love.
Mm.
The subject is that, in this case,
yeah.
referring to the sort of transcendental,
the formless
value,
pure yeah. consciousness self,
and the object being the physical manifestation of
yeah.
that. But they are not,
they're not two things.
At all. And so
you talked about this the other day, actually, and we had a little discussion on terminology and how we sort of describe states of enlightenment.
Right.
And I said that you go from, you know, typically a seeker will be in duality.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say, you know, what we call duality. They imagine themselves to be a person,
yep.
an individual, autonomous thing moving in space and.
Yep.
Whatever, and then the realization comes. Oh, I am quotes the self. I am consciousness.
Right.
But notably, I'm at the first stage of enlightenment. Is typically I'm empty, formless consciousness.
Yeah.
Pure consciousness, let's say, but the manifested experiencing the relative. Then
yeah, the human
isn't at first
the world.
Yeah, the human, the world, everything. Isn't immediately at that stage recognized as
self too.
So as Adyashanti used to call it, there's a manageable duality still,
yes.
even though they're awake.
subtly
to the self, to their nature as consciousness. But so I call that non-duality, and I
you made the point description of it, although I get what you're speaking of entirely,
and that's typically how non-duality is more or less.
But then I'm not a big fan of the non-dual movement.
Well, because it's not, I'm not talking about the non-dual movement.
No, I know you're not. But the terminology that's sometimes used there, because I think there can sometimes be a subtle duality inherent in the ways of describing things.
Well, I'll go out on a limb here.
Okay, good. I think, like limbs.
I think a large majority of the non-dual movement, let's say, don't recognize that there are stages to enlightenment.
True.
I think,
and
a
that's
lot,
what again.
I think that's
one of
where the problem
sort of
is. I think a lot of people wake up into the first stage of enlightenment, recognize themselves as self, and that is enlightenment, and that is awakening.
Yeah.
But it's not unity yet.
No, it's not. It's not a maturity of
because the
that
relativity
awakening.
Hasn't properly been identified as self. Also, and
yeah,
it's only
so there's
when,
a subtle duality there still, and it's very, very subtle. And actually, when you dig down, what's interesting in having conversations with people who have had that initial awakening, let's call it, when you dig down into it, they see that as well.
Yes, and the point is that you can get to that level of awakening and go, oh, I'm awake, that's it, I'm done.
Yeah, and there's no kicking the tires of those assumptions of that subtle duality still. Yeah. And so that's what I mean. When you actually dig down into it in inquiry,
there can be more there to dissolve. But of course, a lot of the traditions have this.
True.
You know, whether you're talking about the Vedanta or the Buddhist, various Buddhist traditions, or, you know, even things like, you know, LOC models and whatnot. These things indicate that there are stages.
Sufi as well.
Sufi, there's part of this. So sharing, there's a part, you can awaken to the self, but it's not complete yet. There's more to go.
Yeah.
And until the whole thing is one singular recognition, one of silence and dynamism, one reality.
Yeah, and that's where the dryness can come in, actually. Yes, I would say that's where the dryness, as in we're talking about the mystery, the love of the mystery, that often comes a little bit later on because those initial stages can feel quite dry, feel quite empty.
Well, it's a bit, because in a sense, it's Maharshi used to talk about this. The first stage of enlightenment, he called it, was cosmic consciousness, where definitionally speaking, it's the self is separate, is perceived as separate from activity.
Yeah.
So separate from the field, the relative field.
You're established in the silence.
You're established in the silent consciousness nature.
Yeah.
But the field of is perceived as and conceived, actually. As separate than the laws of nature, the field of the gunas, that's all. And it's only later when those two start to integrate, even though in some sense it's not even integration, it's a kind of an erasure of the
veils.
False veils that seem to
separate
them.
So
that full heart of devotion seems to that full heart and the expression of, you know, wonder and enchantment and love seem to come deeper into it.
I was going to say it can come prior.
Well, as we talked about the contrast, sometimes waking up from like an afflictive ego to, you know, establishing the self can be a tremendously happy release.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess what I was more trying to get at right then was that you can have that devotional quality and experience of life without awakening.
Yes, of course.
But I would just say there's different flavors or stages even prior to awakening that can sort of be there as well.
Well, because it's always, I mean, you touched on it, you know, awake or not, you are that.
Yeah.
We all are that. Yeah. It's always present. And that's going to, whether we actively recognize that, it's part of our very nature.
Yeah.
It's always nagging at us actually to want to return to that, except the compulsions of the mind and ego keep pulling
have a more of a devotional heart-based nature anyway, you can have those real glimpses and actually live from that sense of wonderment and love of life while still not necessarily recognizing your fundamental nature. I guess that's what I'm trying to point to.
And I do wonder sometimes and worry that some of these devotional approaches can be can turn into a sort of an emotion seeking peak experience seeking.
It's too superficial, I think is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't get into the heart of the merging or the union or the unity of our true nature with our temporary expression of that true nature.
Because, you know, I see this, the devotion to another, to a guru or a saint or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good hook for some to get them going, to allow that love and devotion to flow.
Absolutely.
But ultimately the recognition has to come back to self, that it's not about the object, it's about the subject. And so if that path needs to really, really include that, it needs to sort of, the object of that devotion needs to yield, in a sense, to the recognition of self.
Yeah, I think there's pitfalls in all paths.
Yeah, right.
And I think that is maybe the pitfall of that path.
And I see how we can fall into sentimentalism and, you know, seeking higher and higher states. But then this is it. I started off talking about the value of the ecstatic, you know, that was definitely a big part of this. I didn't get to it, but I was trying to touch on earlier that, you know, as part of my path, the attraction and the, you know, literally the track being attracted to the experience of the ecstatic was a big part of, and sometimes it was quiet ecstasy, you know, sometimes it's just that quiet sitting in the heart of
and your... I would actually say that's a truer ecstasy.
It's not pleasure.
It's not
pleasure
exactly,
seeking.
Exactly, but it's funny how many times I've sort of come up against this with people and my response, although you can have these peak experiences, my response is always that look for the underlying quiet, ubiquitous fragrance rather than the coming and going peak experience.
What's always present.
Yeah. And so that ecstasy, while it might extend out into a peak experience of ecstasy, it rests as itself. The fragrance of ecstasy is present.
Well, again, it's back to the subject, isn't it? It's not mistaking the object as the source for your love, ecstatic experience, devotion, whatever. It doesn't require the object. And in fact, when you drop into the subjectivity, all objects become part of this universal subjective. It's all self.
And part of it too. So then it's not. There's not a rejection of those.
There's not a separation. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I think I interrupted you again.
Might have interrupted you. It's okay. It's part of the course. No, I was going to say something about, again, Adi Shanti. I guess we're talking about Adi today. He's one of the teachers I can happily talk about because I think he's a very, very good teacher. And he talked about, I remember on one of the calls was, actually I might have mentioned this before, probably said it before, but someone had said, oh, I'm looking for peace, I'm looking for peace, you know, where do I find peace? And he says, don't go trying to create peace, but look for the peace that's already present. And I remember at the time that felt like a riddle to me.
They always do though, like, that's the thing.
I didn't know, I couldn't figure out what but that's it, it's already present, so don't go looking for it more and outside. Just keep coming back to your quietness and see, because it's this, the fundamental, or as a seeker, you need to realize that it's all about you and it's all in you, right? It's not about adding anything to you. It's all about always kind of pointing
back. If anything, it's sort of taking away veils of unclear seeing.
Yeah. So it's always
that reveals the truth.
Always about coming back. And the fundamental presumption that one needs to, you know, if one's sort of on this path or struggling with this path or whatever, is the difference between saying, okay, I want to, and this was my experience, right, enlightenment, this idea, and I conceived of it as adding something to me, going, discovering something new, something, whatever, just going and achieving.
A different state.
Or attaining a different state, all out. And, you know, but it's about working on the presumption that you are already everything you'll ever be in your true nature. You're perfect, you're unbroken, non-separate, it's there, but there are conceptual and energetic veils to that reality.
Including views.
So you're looking to purify, for want of a better word, purify the mind-body of energetic and conceptual notions, ideas, foundational axioms that are actually holding you back from recognizing what you already are.
Yeah, it's like that thing of you are what you seek. And actually that leads me on. I was just about to say something else and then I edited myself because I'm like, I was about to say that it's that notion of you are already enlightened, which I really don't like that.
No.
Because it's like, it would be better to say you are already consciousness, but to say you are already enlightened means that you are aware of your nature.
Exactly.
And that is not true.
Yes, exactly. That's the difference. Is it
a lived reality?
Is it abidingly present? Yeah. Is the reality and living
of your
reality
fundamental
of your consciousness
nature
ubiquitous?
Yeah.
Yes.
Not just in thought, but in
experience.
Alive.
I think Luigi used to talk about it as being like, it's like being in the flu state. You know, it's like, you know, when you've got flu, everything that happens in that state.
Yeah, you cook dinner, you're in the flu state.
Yeah.
You're not out of the flu state because
you're having a shower or you're making some food. You're always in it and everything happens from within that.
Yes,
and it's that recognition that you've always got flu. You know, we're awake. But you've got to know it.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be seen from itself. Awareness knows itself.
Yeah. It's like once you know that ground, to transcend our notions of what life is into the reality of our being. And from that, then all experiencing is included. And this is where we come back to the love of life. Yeah. All experiences is included.
It's magic. It's literally magic.
Yeah.
You know, it's that this world that we perceive is this manifestation, a present moment, even the whole of the present moment is a sort of a manifestation of an underlying reality that is consciousness. It's just the self. And it changes everything. And I understand and I am sympathetic to the fact that it is a radical leap from the consensus reality.
Yes.
That this is a present moment manifestation of a field of consciousness, a singular, all-pervasive field of consciousness. And that's the lived reality of it. It's not like that's just an idea. It is how it's experienced.
Yeah.
And the only thing that stops us experiencing that reality is our ideas that it's not that reality.
Yeah.
But beyond those
conceptions, beyond those ideas, we are living that mystery.
It is what is.
Yeah, we are literally, whether we believe ourselves to be or not, whether we think we are or not, whether we see that or not, we are.
That's how it is.
That.
And not just as an assertion, but like, go see.
Yeah, go
if you engage in this the process, if you're, you know, fortunate enough, let's say, to be called and find yourself turning into this a path of awakening, path of, you know, self-realization. It changes your whole reality. And at the same time, reality continues. What's the idea? You know, you awaken to the dream, but the dream continues.
Exactly.
So that's how this goes.
Yeah.
But I get from a from a materialist viewpoint, it's a radically. And I've seen it. And that's the funny thing. I just see it happen in people. When one minute they go and one minute it's conceptual, and then the next minute they see it. They glimpse, ping, it's Kensho. And the nature of reality is just seen as, and life is as it always was, but it's not anymore.
Yeah.
It's completely not what you thought it would be. The concrete, the idea of a concrete universe, of a universe that exists in sort of time and is there when you're not looking at it.
Yeah, well, that might come later, that glimpse. The initial glimpse of I'm not as solid as I thought I was.
Well, I don't know. I've seen that when it comes online as simply, oh, the whole thing said, well, look at you. It wasn't just about you not. I'm talking about that particular glimpse you had before the retreat that time. There was, you were like, me and the tree are one.
Yes.
There was no locality there. It was singular kind of. But what I would say is that as the awakening, let's say, matures, as it becomes embodied, you know, a couple of things can happen, and they're both. And one of them is that what we've been talking about, this sense of love and bliss and, you know, peace and joy, that but the active sort of experience that of wonderment and enchantment, and that really can awaken, but also the sense of the also come back down to earth with it.
Yeah.
Like, we're sitting here at a table with mics and a computer and a cup of coffee, and we're talking as human beings. You know, we're not like so overwhelmed by the wonder and the bliss that we can't even function. That can happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are famous people like Ramakrishna, I talked about before. He was profoundly enlightened, and he would just pass out in the reverie of overwhelming ecstatic bliss frequently. You know, there are people kind of picking him up, and you'd see something and it would knock him out because it was just the bliss and that experience. So that you, there are these ecstatic saints.
Yeah.
And at the same time, and also here we are living. I live with that sense of wonder and bliss.
Yeah, and
joy,
there can also be,
but also I can function.
Well, but also there can be phases and seasons and times of your life where that is more, I want to say, necessary. It's like I see it of you. Like, you know, there's times where that sort of what we call swooning is very much more
prominent,
apparent and common. And then there are other times where actually it is much more integrated in terms of what we would call, you know, functioning on this,
just moving
in this
in
dream
a sort of a
world.
Normal way in the world.
And I think that, you know, different times call for different things. And it's interesting, it's just slightly changed tack here a little bit, but I think it will relate to it. Someone asked me a few days ago, you know, what's my experience of the body? And why I say that is because it's like there is a functioning that is there when it's needed, and when it's not needed, it completely drops back into the bliss of the self.
The
beingness of the self. So there is a body there when it's needed in the dream, functionally there is a body there, but because there's not a belief that I am that body, it's like a dreamlike body almost. It disappears very easily. It's not so solid. And yet when there is attention needed in that functioning level, it's very much that. It's very, very, in some ways, more solid and more real and more, you know, more grounded in the body. So I guess what I'm trying to communicate is, you know, this idea of the swooning versus the so the emerging back into the self versus the functioning in the relative. it happens when it needs to happen. The different movements of that, the withdrawal, let's call it, of the relative into the absolute.
Yeah, like
happens when it's needed to happen, and equally when there is a relative play that is needed, there it is.
Yeah.
There's the functioning, there's the body, there's the experience,
the activity,
of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not either or, it is both. But it's like...
But the ground remains.
The ground remains
ever
always
present and ubiquitous, yeah.
But sometimes that ground is all that... it's like the blank canvas. Sometimes there's a blank canvas. Yeah. Sometimes it's still canvas, but there is a big foreground painting on it as well.
But even so, the ground, the ground is... again, descriptions, we use ground a lot. But it's also the perception that, the recognition that everywhere, like your attention lands, is consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So the ground is pervading all the outer appearances also. It's not necessarily just the background. It's indistinguishable or rather inseparable from...
Well, the form is made up of that. They're not separate. But it's almost like consciousness at rest versus consciousness in motion.
Sure.
So at rest is the sort of the absolute. In motion is the relative. They're not separate. It is both consciousness. Yeah. It is both consciousness.
It is all consciousness.
It's just it's consciousness
in different
modes. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And that consciousness in motion, I would describe as love, actually.
Yeah, which is actually a more technical description than we care to, right?
No.
Well, the reason I've sort of been thought about this before, that there's an idea, it's a philosophical idea that says, I can't remember who the key philosopher was, says that no one acts out of for anything other than the good, but it's a perceived good. Mm-hmm. So everyone acts for the good. Everyone's always acting for their perceived good. All things available. So that movement is moving towards the good, always towards the good. And okay,
towards
so people
love.
Can do love, and that motion is love, and the object of that is love, and the source of it is love. It's all love. It's love. Mm-hmm. And so every motion of everything now, at any given point of reality, you could pick someone who's just a terrible perpetrator of misery, but in their perception, then what they do is moving towards the good. And however small, you could argue that it's that motion of love, technically speaking, not just I feel love. It's the movement towards the good, however corrupt and perverted that is.
Yeah. And sometimes that movement needs to go 10 steps back, but it seemingly goes 10 steps back, but it is still the motion towards
that force that's moving, and what it's moving towards is love. But say in someone,
it's just not a linear way.
No, they're well, just that their being, their person has been so, whether it's genetic or whether it's environmental and whatnot, people get broken, people get traumatized, and their
view of what is North Pole is distorted.
But still, the fact that they're moving towards what they prefer is in itself moving towards a good, and that movement is I would make the case that that's actually the technical thing of love, and it ultimately that finds its fullness. Marsh used to say something like consciousness is the source, course, and goal of all of reality. And you could equally say love is the source, course, and goal, and it's the motivating force, and it's the direction that force takes, and it's the object that's aiming for. It's all this movement of, and
which is hard to see when what you perceive on the surface level is harm.
That's why I'm reverting to saying, look, this is kind of more technical than saying, hey man, it's all love. That might be true, but it needs qualifying that, you know, what motivates all human act? You see it in animals, you see it in plants, you know, is not the movement of a plant to growth, expansion and sunlight. And, you know, that movement, you could call that movement love, you know, that direction from like, you know, this to that wants to expand. And so love is this expansion, but love is also the directionality.
Mm-hmm.
It's moving towards more peace, more, you know, joy, even though, granted, that can look so insane if the person, for example, is so broken. And so, you know, again, it's this idea that all the problems in the world are actually just not enough love. You know, technically speaking, that they need to, but and this goes back to the non-doing thing. This field of consciousness is also a field of creative intelligence, stirring and moving and evolving.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about the difference between this dream, this waking dream, and the dream you have at night. And my observation is that, well, the dream you have at night still is happening in consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's just, again, it's a dream reality happening in consciousness, but there's no law there. There's no regularity. There's no consistencies. There's no predictabilities. Time, there's no evolution. Space. It just happens in random ways.
Gravity.
But this reality, yes, it's arguably is Maya, right? It's illusion. It's not real. Well, that's really noisy on the mic. Anyway, it's not, you know, it's not corporeal, but it follows laws of nature. It unfolds and unpacks in a
continuity.
In a continuity, as mathematical precision, right all the way down and all the way up. And that's the interesting thing. So what's the difference in quality? It's the same stuff. It's consciousness. It's mind stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dreamlike reality in this field of being, conscious intelligence.
But different dimensions have different laws of nature. You could call it.
Exactly. Well, this has laws.
But I would argue
the dream has its own logic. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, different celestial realms and stuff like that have different laws of nature. Let's call them.
Yeah. So I don't know how we got to that, but we do that.
We do that all the time.
Yeah, where were we? Yeah, so love is what we were talking about, and
where we started, and where so we are like now.
It's the way that evolution occurs is through this the motion, action, and direction of love, moving from, you know, a present to an expanded, fuller, more true experience. Mm.
Yeah. And so to notice that is to fall in love with life.
Yeah. So on this subject of the natural sense of enchantment and wonder that arises from a pure mind, let's say, an awakened mind, and before, but it's still even before awakening, it's still a function of our nature revealing itself. It reminds me of the Zen book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And, you know, the whole Zen approach is to gain this non-conceptual condition, to live from there.
To come back to that.
Yeah.
And the simplicity of that,
the
and
pure
actually,
simplicity of it.
You know, what it reveals is you do not need to know how to live. You are just living.
Yeah.
And we get caught up in the feeling of I need to know how to live. And yet, it's such an untruth.
Well, yeah, children do all right. As you were saying earlier, you know, they don't know what the hell's going on. They're just but they've got the sense of wonder and the sense of, and so there's a great similarity between a child and an awakened being.
It's just the awakened being is aware of the nature.
Well, I think there's a, so I remember someone suggested once in the past that they had kids and they said, kids are enlightened, naturally enlightened. And I get where they came from with that, but it's not quite the case, but it actually points to something interesting. And I think the reason, there's a great, it's as enlightened, you know, being 1.5 years old, floating around, playing, you know, there's no self, there's no personal self there.
They're in the natural state.
But the trouble is, because of the development thing, the developmental stages, the child will, as a function of healthy development, develop a sense of their own egoic self.
Yeah, their individuation.
Yeah, and so in a sense, they're vulnerable to that. Yeah. And so it's not enlightenment, because enlightenment isn't vulnerable to that, because you've started off in a natural state. And actually, I can't remember, there's this esoteric formula to do with this, that the three conditions is the original natural state, mm-hmm. And then the fall, mm-hmm. and where that natural state is lost, but then the rediscovery, but full integration, so that state won't get lost.
Yeah, so I've described this from my own viewpoint of perspective. There's the innocence, then there's the loss of that innocence, and then there is the return of that innocence, but with wisdom.
There you go.
And that, to me, and is that's the what description. We're seeking. Yeah.
So that childhood, let's say, mm-hmm. is a taste. Like
it's innocence. It is innocence. It's the natural state.
But that innocence is vulnerable
because there's no wisdom. Insight of what is that innocence. Yeah.
You're no longer, you know, this is the thing with awakening. You see through the concepts. You see the concepts of what they are. But before that, you take the concepts to be, you know, you reify them. You take don't them see to that be they concrete are concepts. And real. Yeah. Exactly. And so as long as you haven't, you could be in a state of natural innocence looking at a sun saying, oh, no, this is wonderful.
And no concepts around it.
No concept, and be just completely open and wondrous. And that's where people have glimpses, but wonder why they can't keep hold of them.
Yeah.
Because when those concepts sort of the aperture of conceptual thinking kind of comes back, there's no defense. So you have to...
Yeah, you see, that is a concept. And that is the liberating insight.
Yeah, concepts in general, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe we'll wrap it up for today. We're about 1 hour 15. It's a bit shorter than we have done, but that's okay. I think it's been a nice chat.
It has indeed.
Yeah, you're happy to?
Yeah. Just to impart as we leave.
Yeah.
For anyone listening out there, to find the miraculous in the ordinary. And in order to do that, you have to let go of your expectations.
Yes.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today.
Yeah, thank you. Always fun.
Yes.
Okay, well, see you soon. See you next week.
Bye for now.
Bye.